Colleagues, members of the public, today is Monday, the 20th of April, and this is the Senate Committee on Workforce. Welcome, everyone. We have a lot of bills to get through today, and hopefully we'll be able to get through everything that's on our docket by 3 o'clock. If not, we'll have to come back at 6 to wrap up, but let's give it our best shot. So I'm going to open our first bill, which is Senate Bill 865. And I'd like to call up Senator Girard. And President Courtney, are you willing to join Senator Girard at the... Yes, Matt, could you tell us what this bill does?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 865 authorizes counties to exempt homesteads of surviving spouses of fire service professionals or public or police officers killed in the line of duty from property taxes imposed by the county. It takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment sine die. There are -2 amendments which authorize the county to exempt homesteads of surviving spouses of fire service professionals or police officers killed in the line of duty from county property taxes on the first $250,000 of assessed value of homesteads and establishes a process for requesting the exemption. There are light statements for both revenue and fiscal.
And this has a subsequent referral to?
Yes, this will have a subsequent referral to revenue.
Okay, Senator Girard, thank you for bringing this bill and for sharing the table with the man to your left.
It's a challenge. That is a challenge. Chair Dembrough, I'm Senator Fred Girard. I represent Senate District 9. Colleagues, this is a real simple bill. Senate Bill 865, as the administrator says, basically would exempt property tax for those first responders, firemen and policemen, who die in the line of duty. We worked with the Revenue Department to come up with a -2 amendments. If you look at those, what that does is it caps at $250,000 the assessed value, so that's the maximum they could receive. Please be aware that this is a may, not a shall, so it is permissive. It also makes clear that this is for all property taxes. It's not just for county property tax. So this would be for all property tax, and it standardizes the application for the county to make that request to the Department of Revenue. That was the reasons for the -2. So again, it's a real simple bill. It would speak loudly for the state and the people that we are. These people put their lives on the line every day for us, and I think that this is a good bill. If that need comes present, that they are killed in the line of duty, that their spouse gets some benefit. So again, this very simple bill, it just allows for the tax, property tax to be exempted for those that are killed in the line of duty for the spouse. I ask for your support.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Courtney.
Thank you, Chair Dembrough. My name is Peter Courtney. I'm a state senator from District 11, which includes portions of Salem, Jervis, and Woodburn. Vice Chair Thatcher and members of the Senate Workforce Committee. I come here today to show support and to be very supportive of this piece of legislation, SB 865. This measure has been pointed out by the Honorable Senator Fred Girard, exempts the surviving spouse of a fire service or a police officer from county property taxes. I want to thank the good senator for bringing this measure, and I'm proud that he asked me to be a major sponsor. Senator Girard and others here will provide you with all the details, as he already has, as to what the bill is exactly about. Just as a personal note, as you know, my youngest son is a hotshot firefighter. He battles fires all throughout the mighty West. I can't begin to explain to you the feeling you have as a parent when your son tells you he's yet on another fire line. He's on a line as we speak. I've had to ask him to stop sending pictures of the fires, particularly home to his mother. Just a few years ago, an entire hotshot crew was lost in a blaze. It is something I and anyone with a family member in this line of work thinks about every day. And while I'm talking about the fire, I think it'd be also true of police work. The risk these people take on, both our firefighters and our police officers, is immense. They put their lives on the line. This bill is a small token of our appreciation and commitment. It is a way of showing the men and women who put their lives on the line for us every day that we won't abandon their families should the unthinkable happen. Again, thank you, Chair Dembrough, Vice Chair Thatcher, for allowing me to come here today and to speak about this piece of legislation. And again, thank you, Senator Fred Gerard, for introducing this bill.
Thank you, Senators. Colleagues, questions?
Well, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you both very much. Okay, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 865. And open a work session on Senate Bill 865.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 865. Oh, wait. I move we adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated April 16th, 2015.
Okay, Vice Chair Thatcher has moved to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated April 16th, 2015. Any discussion of the amendments? Any objection to our adopting these amendments? Seeing none, they are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 865 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Finance and Revenue. Whoops, by prior reference. There we go.
Vice Chair Thatcher has moved Senate Bill 865 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Finance and Revenue by prior reference. Any discussion of this bill? Is there any objection to our passing this bill? Seeing none, the motion passes. The bill will be sent as amended to the Committee on Finance and Revenue. With that, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 865. And I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 814. Betsy, are you okay coming up and presenting it? I think Bill should be coming any time. And Sean, and Bill can join us. Yeah, please, Matt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 814 establishes the state preemption of authority to require mandatory provision of employment benefits to employees of private employers. It declares an emergency and is effective on passage. There is no revenue impact statement, but there is a light fiscal impact statement.
Okay, thank you, Matt. Who wants to start?
All right, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller, here today in support of Senate Bill 814. Here representing the Northwest Grocery Association and the Portland Business Alliance. And, we view employment law and a lot of the different requirements of employee-employee relationships at the state level. And I think what we've encountered, especially in the last few years, Mr. Chairman, is an increasing number of a patchwork approach, which has been very concerning. And I know the issue we've probably most been talking about it is in the area of sick leave this session, but there's several others. And I know when we look at, statewide policies of employment law, family leave, minimum wage, unemployment, workers' comp, a lot of these areas have been developed on a statewide approach. And we've worked on a lot of those issues together. Sometimes we agree or disagree on different policies. And regardless of that, we'd like to have those discussions in the building. In this building, in the Capitol. I think, I think increasingly over the last few years, we've seen efforts moving to maybe a few cities and then coming into the building and then having that patchwork approach. Sick leave, I think, Mr. Chairman, is a prime example. Portland did adopt the first sick leave ordinance, and then the city of Eugene, and now we're here having the discussion. I think if you look at all three proposals before you, Portland is slightly different than Eugene. The statewide approach, I think, is slightly different or could be slightly different.
again, dealing with these issues at a statewide level. The next issue, flex scheduling, is another prime example that's probably to come. That is the reason why we're asking for these preemptions. Again, we can disagree or agree on these issues in here, but having that patchwork approach has been a problem. And ban the box is another example where there's several different approaches that I know could take place. So, Chairman, I know we're here today in support of the bill, and I'll turn it over to Betsy to elaborate. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries and appearing before you in support of Senate Bill 814. I think Sean encapsulated a lot of the concerns that we have had in the last several years. We have seen more and more of the public policy around employment matters moving from the building, if proponents are not successful here, into local governments, pushing the policies there, having them adopted perhaps, and then using that adoption to drive the discussion in Salem. And it's our position that policies having to do with employers that are so critical to jobs in the economy are more appropriately held in this building, in the state legislature, than in local governments. That is one concern we have. Another concern we have with having local governments be able to adopt their own employment mandates is that we have some members that have locations in several different places around the state, and that makes it extremely difficult to manage a workforce in Oregon, not even just a big company that has, you know, a store in every town, but smaller employers that have perhaps two or three stores. It's costly to administer no matter what the size of the employer is if you have several different policies that you have to keep track of, and we would prefer to see those conversations happening in the state legislature, and that is our reason for support of Senate Bill 814.
Thank you, Chair Dembro. Members of the committee, for the record, Bill Perry with the Oregon Restaurant Lodging Association. We're here also in support of the concept between 814. Obviously, when you look at a lot of policies and effects, they're becoming more and more at the local level. And when you take some of the examples like this committee has had on sick leave and some of the minimum wage and other, those are cost drivers for a business. Now, we can say they're good or bad policies, but they're cost drivers. So if you implement as a legislature one of those cost drivers on the business and you give somebody time to prepare for them, generally they're hoping to do that without laying off or reducing hours or doing some different things. But what happens when you guys leave the building and local governments start to add things on top of it, that's where the job loss or job restrictions really start to happen, is because the playing field kind of moves constantly and employers really never have a chance to catch up. And the legislative process is really about compromise, and depending on your city you're from, you could have, you know, four liberal people or five liberal people or five conservative people. There just isn't the kind of both sides of the issue at the local level. You see a lot of anti-labor things going on at local level in the South. So there's a lot of different things that, you know, the compromise position can help if we try to focus the arguments here. Because as of right now, if people have to compromise, then they tend to either want to go to the ballot or to the local governments so they can get a proposal that is more to their liking. And that really is against what I think the premise of the legislative process is, which is let's compromise. With that, I want to end with kind of one little story. I was meeting in the city of Portland with a specific councilman, and they were talking about how vibrant the restaurant industry was in Portland. And so I asked them, well, what do you mean by vibrant? And they said, seems like new restaurants are opening up all the time. And I said, well, yeah, they're opening and constantly in places that have just closed down. And the two staff people actually kind of snickered at that. You'll see some of these places right in the base of office buildings that are every year there's a new restaurant. It's just because of the constant changing environment, they just can't, independent restaurants can't seem to exist. They need some stability. We need a kind of moral thorough deliberation process like you have in the legislature, and we need a little bit more stability. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions of the panel? Yes, Vice Chair Thatcher.
Bill, you kind of struck on something that kind of made me think about like international franchises. McDonald's, for instance, they're a good target. They have to deal with a patchwork of regulations all over the world, and so they could probably adapt to a patchwork within a state fairly nimbly. It's the independents that are most affected, it sounds like.
Chair Dembro, Senator Thatcher, that is true, except for when you have the high cost of doing business here in the state, you're going to find there's very few company-owned stores. Generally, what you do is you have a set of franchisees here. But I would, to your point, if you've got one operation, you generally don't have an HR person, you don't have an advertising company, you're doing it all yourself. The bigger you get, the more expertise. You might have an HR person, you might have some different things that can kind of deal with these things. So I completely agree with your argument. The bigger you are, the more capital you might have, but then you start in to get to the, now you have a different standard in each community. So I mean, it's going to affect a chain a lot differently. It's still negative than it is an independent. But yeah, the smaller your operation is, the less capital you have to adjust to some of these changes.
Okay, Mr. Chair. And then you hit on something else. The franchises, those are some kind of like independently owned, but they have the international name and recognition and have all those processes. So is that, where would you put them? In this small category?
Chair Dembro, Senator Thatcher, that's a good question. I mean, some people, if you have like a Dairy Queen, Subway, Quiznos, they tend to be one or two operations. Some of the bigger ones, Taco Bell's, and some of those might have multiple. They tend to have more locations than the others. But, you know, it's almost like if you remember us talking about menu labeling a few years back, the point we made was adjust to the California standard because they're a big enough market to where the suppliers will make adjustments. Oregon is a small market, and especially if you start to get to Portland or others, the smaller your market, the less likely you're going to get suppliers or corporations to help you with those adjustments. You pretty much got to come up with it on your own. But it really kind of depends on the restaurant, how many units you might have. But there are, like I said, Subway, Dairy Queen, those guys tend to have one or two units, where some of the others might have, you know, 10 to 12.
I have a question. So the bill calls for a preemption on all employment benefits. That seems pretty broad, right? I mean, can you how do you define benefits? I mean, do you define benefit? I mean, are you thinking that we're talking just about fringe benefits, or do you see it as applying more broadly than that?
Mr. Chair, I think we view it as all terms of conditions of employment. And so I think the broader view of any terms or conditions of employment is how we view it. Again, you know, one of the examples I like to use is, you know, a lot of the companies I represent are collective bargaining. So, you know, we do sit at the bargaining table with the unions and actually work through a lot of these and negotiate a lot of the items that we're contemplating. And again, you know, we can have this discussion in this building, but if we do it in four or five other different cities and have different, you know, issues applying to not only our collective and bargaining agreement, but this patchwork approach, you know, again, we think that broader, or at least that broader discussion should be brought in this building, and you know, laws could be passed here. Again, we can agree or disagree, but I think we view the broader any terms and conditions of employment.
Yeah, Chair Dembro, members of the committee, I would argue, I don't know if this is necessarily broad enough, because, I mean, remember, there isn't unique examples per se in Portland or Eugene. They're becoming a test ground. That's all it is. It's just a test ground. If there's something specifically that's happening different in the city of Portland, there's nothing that prevents them from coming to the legislature and said, we've got a very unique example here. Can we do a pilot project? You do pilot projects all the time. But when you look at our employee manuals, a lot of times if you've got multiple units, they're the same. We also offer employee manuals as a part of our membership that goes to independents because they don't have the ability to draft their own employee manuals. So there's a lot of things you do in governing employees that, you know, the more consistent, then the more you can have basically the ability to share costs, you're going to be better off. But, you know, if there is something that needs to be specific to a local jurisdiction and they want to try something, there's nothing that prevents them from coming to the legislature and asking for a pilot project. That happens all the time in different things.
Okay, Thank you. Yes, Senator Rosemary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am just curious why this is only applies to employment. We have local laws about all sorts of things. We have a plastic bag ban that Portland passed a couple of years ago. So I get this is your issue, but do you think that we should do that for everything?
Do you really want to
answer? Oh, I'm just curious.
I think I've probably passed more preemptions than anybody in this building. No, it's the consistency. You know, I think most of you know I grew up in the Dalles, and when I was younger, you didn't go to Hood River that much, which was 19 miles away. And today's, as the state spreads and people drive more, these things can really become competitive disadvantages for a lot of different reasons. And so, no, the local governments have become probably the biggest problem for small business. They just have in many different facets. If you want to go broader, I think our members would be supportive. But it seems like, as of right now, even if you look at the issues that are in front of the legislature, they tend to be mostly labor stuff. And I think there are, you know, nine times out of ten on these labor issues, you know, I think you're seeing it in some of the different version of the House. If we're all forced to come here and compromise, I think there's a way we can figure out something that works, even taking kind of baby steps to accomplish the goals you want to do. But as people figure out that there's ever other avenues outside the legislative process, they tend to ask for more than they probably should. And both sides of the aisle. I think it depends on whether you're talking rural cities or urban cities. Their bents are going to be totally different. And so from a business standpoint, it would just be important that I think we have that deliberative process that happens in the legislative arena and try to make sure that all those happen here.
And one additional question. So it seems like what you just said, that urban, rural are very different, that the local government folks would be in the best position to know what would work for their particular community. Do you think that we should be substituting our judgment for theirs?
Well, Chair Dembro, Senator Rosenbaum, I mean, it comes down to, okay, say sick leave. Is there a reason that are the people in Portland more or less sick than the ones in Baker City? I mean,
I'm not going to answer that.
No, it is. If there is an issue that is of concern, then I think we should have it here. If, like you said, is there a specific issue that, like, say we have some sort of an outbreak or a bunch of employers in Baker City that also started to do it, you come and you have the process saying, let's see if a process that everybody agrees upon can work in a local jurisdiction. You get a pilot project. Most of the labor issues that we're talking about are not specific to an urban versus rural. So the question is why should one be different, I think, is also as important as the policy itself.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
We're going to have to move on to the next. Appreciate that. Now it's time to hear from the cities. So Mayor Peter Truax, Commissioner Steve Novick, and Scott Winkles, if you would please come up.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I represent the League of Oregon Cities. The League of Oregon Cities is comprised of all 242 incorporated cities in the state of Oregon, and we are appearing with concerns in regards to Senate Bill 814. Before I begin my remarks, I would like to respond a little bit to the previous panel, where it was stated that this was indicated that this was a more deliberative process. And I would point out to the chair in your opening remarks that you indicated that you wish to be completed with your hearings by 3 o'clock. And then that would satisfy the public hearing requirement for this legislation, and then it could receive a work session and be reported to the floor. The ordinance process is actually a little bit more complicated than the deliberation that this bill would receive. There would be postings, multiple hearings, work sessions, and ample opportunity for public comment, all of which could be referred to the voters with a fairly low margin of signatures to be gathered. To suggest that cities would take something lightly or act capriciously, I think does not reflect simply how cities operate in the state. With that, I do believe that Senate Bill 814 is written overly broad. We believe not only would it prevent a city from requiring an employment benefit, we believe it would also impact our ability to place requirements on things like public contracts, where we can, under the current contracting code, cities can adopt their own rules and place requirements on those contracts for certain wages and benefits, and where we've seen that happen by whether council action or by initiative process, that authority would be preempted. Why we oppose that, I'm going to leave to Mayor Truax, who is the mayor of Forest Grove and this year's president of the League of Oregon Cities.
Welcome, Mayor.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Dembrough. Chair Dembrough and Commission, Senate Bill 814 seeks to preempt the ability of the City Council to require employers to provide benefits to their employees. Now, the League recognizes the state has the authority to do this. We also believe the state should set a minimum standard, allowing cities to determine if those minimums meet local needs, provide for the quality of life and economic vitality that every city in the state of Oregon, as well as the legislature, is seeking to foster. Home rule, or as we like to call it, local control, local options, was not developed by the LOC as some sort of clever messaging. It's not part of a branding exercise. No focus groups were harmed in the creation as a principle the League stands on. All 242 cities in the state of Oregon are home rule cities. Rather, the League views local control as the chief tenet of governing and is not a concept to be supported when the legislature happens to like how the locals are controlling. A couple of statements. In addition, the Home Rule Authority was placed in the Oregon Constitution over 100 years ago, and the electorate of each city has endorsed it by the passage of their Home Rule Charter. Voters did this in the early 1900s because, like today, people feel that a government that is closest to the people should have the authority to address their needs without asking permission of a higher authority. No pun intended there. That's the definition of home rule. The League agrees there are times when the state must set a requirement to preempt local authority. Cities do not object to requirements that people have faith in government, such as audits and ethics codes. Preemption in this bill, however, is not such a measure. To take away the ability of a city to tailor local workplace requirements is to rob the state of the potential of innovation. Many of the protections that Oregon has enacted, improving fairness and the quality of life for working Oregonians, started at the local level. To accept the argument that a patchwork of requirements on businesses is disaster is to say that we will no longer allow cities to experiment. I want to remind you that, again, one size does not indeed fit all. It was Oregon's local governments that first passed ordinance that said your private life was none of your employer's business. Would Oregon's protections be as strong if cities had not acted in such a fashion? We believe this bill would restrict the ability of a city to require wages and benefits in public contracting. Legislature heard testimony on another bill in another committee that some employers of the disabled may be paying as low as a quarter an hour, 25 cents. Is the legislature prepared to say we cannot require the minimum wage in a public contract? We don't use this authority capriciously and lightly and without a protracted, inclusive, and transparent process. Mr. Winkles mentioned our process of enacting ordinances. For example, in Forest Grove, our medical marijuana ordinance received its first hearing last Monday night and its first public hearing. The public hearing will continue next Monday night. The second reading will be next Monday night, and we will determine, after we've had two meetings and 2 weeks of people having the opportunity to input information to the city of Forest Grove on that particular issue. So that's just an example of what we're trying to do in working with local control, and I thank the committee for its time.
Thank you very much, Mayor. And could you, just for the record, give us your name and your own...
My name is Peter Truax. I'm the mayor of Forest Grove and the president of the League of Oregon Cities.
Thank you very much. Commissioner, welcome.
Chair Dembrough, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee, my name is Steve Novick. I'm a Portland City Commissioner, and my comments will be largely duplicative of the mayor's.
We believe this is an overly broad proposal, severely limiting the ability of local governments to adopt protections for workers. Local communities, cities, counties, indeed states, have been laboratories for innovation and have often led the way in adopting new public policies that protect workers and residents long before states or the federal government have considered action. In 1991, the city of Portland added discrimination based on sexual orientation or source of income in housing, employment, and public accommodations to the city's civil rights ordinance. The legislature did not pass such legislation until 2007. I believe a vote for this bill would be, in effect, a declaration that discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation should have been legal in the city of Portland from 1991 to 2007. In the year 2000, the city of Portland updated its ordinance banning discrimination based on gender identity. This is the first time a community in Oregon stepped forward to protect the employment rights of transgender people. Again, it wasn't until 2007 that the state adopted similar protections. So I believe a vote for this bill is a vote for the proposition that between 2000 and 2007, discrimination based on gender identity should have been legal in the city of Portland. As the mayor said, we believe the sweeping language of this bill would restrict cities from protecting the rights of workers on city projects through requirements that contractors include non-discrimination provisions, their employment benefits. Because employment benefits are so broadly defined in the bill, Senate Bill 814 may intrude in the city's ability to operate apprenticeship programs critical to increasing the numbers of women and minorities in the construction trades and developing a diverse and qualified workforce. And the bill may interfere with the city's minority, women, and emerging small businesses program, which strives to provide equity in contracting opportunities for historically disadvantaged communities, and that the bill would jeopardize Portland's local community benefit agreements, which require expanded opportunities for certified MWESB firms and parity in benefits between union and non-union shops in large city projects. We also believe that if the proposition that the state should preempt any local protection of workers logically leads to the proposition that the federal government should preempt any state protections of workers. And it was in 1903 that the state of Oregon first adopted a limitation on the number of hours that women could be required to work in factories, a 10-hour limit. It wasn't until 1938 that the federal government adopted the Fair Labor Standards Act. Again, we believe a vote for this bill is, in effect, a vote for the proposition that the women of Oregon should have been required to work for more than 10 hours a day between 1903 and 1938. So very much appreciate the opportunity to address the committee and hope that you will not allow this bill to go forward.
Thank you, all three of you. Questions of the panel? Yes, Mr. Thatcher.
Thank you for your testimony. And I do sympathize. This is like a tug of war. It's like, well, what makes for a good policy at the local level versus the state level versus the federal level, and all these things are happening. And I sympathize with that. I do sort of take exception with the fact that if you support benefits being prescribed by one body, that you're a homophobe or sexist, which is kind of like what you're saying. I don't believe that a benefit, that discrimination or not discriminating, is a benefit. So if we can look at maybe amending something, so that's very clear. That's a provision of a benefit is completely separate from discrimination or standards of discrimination in my view. So.
And I'll just say before you go in that, you know, we heard from the first panel that, you know, the spirit behind this bill is that it preempt all employment practices. And so that would include discrimination.
Benefits is what I thought, but okay.
Chair Dembro, yeah. Vice Chair Thatcher, if I may, it was our understanding, listening to Mr. Miller in particular, that he said that this would apply to all terms and conditions of employment. So. I assume that means that an employer could provide that a term and condition of employment is, for example, not being gay. But even if it is limited strictly to what we normally think of as benefits, I would think that it would be clear that local government would not be able to require employers to provide similar benefits to people in different groups. So, for example, I feel quite certain that if this bill had been in effect, an employer would have been able to say, I can give vacation time to my straight employees but not my gay employees because you can't regulate benefits.
And, Chair Dembro, Senator Thatcher, if I may, I think the point in bringing that up isn't to cast aspersions. The point is to suggest that it's cities and local governments that were the first to innovate and go in that direction, and that they wouldn't have the ability to do that had something like this been enacted. But I'm looking at the bill right now, and it does say any employment benefit, and it uses a fairly broad definition of what employment benefit means. And I think it could go so far as to say that an employer, that the city couldn't offer an incentive to, say, encourage use of mass transit if you're having a traffic parking or a traffic or parking issue in downtown, because the issue of an incentive is a requirement that the employer do something to accept that. And I think that language does appear to be overly broad. But again, our point is that what the current state of the statute allows is local governments to be creative and to innovate. And that's something that we think should be protected.
Okay, thank you, Mayor and Commissioner, for coming to Salem, and Scott for your testimony. Let's hear from Jan Meekums and J.L. Wilson, please. Or Jan Meekums and Jan Meekums.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Dembrough, and members of the committee for allowing me the opportunity to testify today on Senate Bill 814. For the record, my name is Jan Meekums. I'm the State Director of NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business. We have about 7,000 members that are small, privately owned businesses in the state of Oregon. We have about 350,000 members nationwide, and we've been advocating on behalf of small businesses since 1943. We are supportive of this business. Much of my testimony has already been given by the previous business panel, so I know you're under the gun today, so I'll make it very quick. One thing is that this is regarding private employers, which are our membership. And if you look at the definition of local government, it includes a county, city, district, or other public corporation, and just cities alone, there were 242 that were cited by the previous testimony. If you look at each of those authorities having the ability to create their separate ordinances regarding employment, for the small business employer particularly, that represents about 92% of all employers in the state and over half of all the employment, that potential is very ominous. It costs small businesses about 36% more to implement regulation than it does a large business. And if you look at innovation and to suggest that if we left these matters at the state level, that it would reduce innovation, I think that there's an opportunity that the state legislature does allow for the opportunity for public testimony, for bills to be written, for innovation to be introduced at the state level as well as at the local level. The potential for a patchwork of these employment legislation, where employment law is already one of the most difficult regulatory areas for the small business owner, and they don't have an HR department, they don't have often in-house bookkeepers, it makes it very difficult. For our members that are in the city of Portland and they work in the metro area, I have already received reports that it's very difficult if they don't offer, for instance, the paid sick leave per the ordinance of Oregon. They are outside of the geographic area of Oregon as far as their business, but they do have clients inside of Portland. It makes it very difficult to track and to figure out how to operate within that environment. And we are very supportive of this bill, and I would like to, we have a site called Small Business for Sensible Regulation that NFIB has posted a lot of information regarding regulation and small business. And one point of several facts. According to the NFIB Small Business Optimism Index, small business owners have cited regulations as a top impediment to conducting business for over 65 months in a row. And this is just to try and roll back some of these layers of regulation that small businesses must contend with on a daily basis to allow them to get on with the business of providing the goods and services, expanding their business, and growing jobs. And with that, so again, we're strongly supportive of this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Meekums.
Yes.
Any questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next panel, Andrea Peluso, Kevin Billman, or Jeffra Anderson, and Graham Traynor. Andrea, welcome, and congratulations on your recent honor.
Thank you. You're just embarrassing me now. Chair Dembro, members of the committee, my name is Andrea Peluso, again, Executive Director of Family Forward, and I come before you today in strong opposition to Senate Bill 814, which we believe would strip local governments of their ability to set policies on anything related to working conditions. The sweeping preemption contained in this bill would be unprecedented in Oregon and would effectively tie the hands of localities to determine the policies that work best in our own communities. It's a serious overreach by the state and constitutes major interference in local decision-making and local control. Oregon has a strong tradition and value around home rule and protecting local jurisdictions' ability to settle matters of local concern. We have had home rule standards for cities in place since 1906, where localities have had home rule authority granted explicitly in the Oregon Constitution. Local governments have used this authority to set health, safety, and workplace standards for their residents and are often, as we've heard, at the forefront of setting policy and responding to emerging issues. Several historic laws that some have already been mentioned have been enacted first at the local level, including non-discrimination standards and clean indoor air protections, both of which would have been prohibited if this legislation before you had been in place at those times. In many ways, local jurisdictions are the testing ground for new ideas and proposals that are later taken up by the legislature. Senate Bill 814 would undermine the constitutional power of localities in a broad and unjustified way. We've heard from a couple of folks that operating in cities is like operating outside the legislative process, but I'd like to clarify that cities also have strong legislative processes. We are not operating outside of any legislative process by working at the city level. State interference and local control, as ascribed by this bill, is not a uniquely Oregon idea either. These increasingly prevalent strategies that stop the people in local communities from being able to pass their own laws and that strip local governments of their lawmaking authority are being promoted nationally by the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, a group that drafts and distributes models for state-level legislation written to benefit large corporations and industries. The bill you see before you mirrors much of the language we see in similar pieces of legislation in other states. We believe there are a number of negative unintended consequences, which we've outlined in a memo that was submitted with our testimony from our attorneys from A Better Balance that describe some of the negative unintended consequences of Senate Bill 814. We can never know what policy a local government may want to enact in the future to promote its community's goals and values. Innovation, as you've heard, often happens at the local level. Sometimes it's in Portland, but sometimes it's in Coos Bay or Springfield, too. Employers that are unfortunate enough to operate in multiple cities are used to a variety of different laws, including land use, zoning, environmental standards, and others. We believe this bill sets a dangerous precedent and in Oregon, a state with a long history of protecting home rule, and we urge you to oppose it. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrea. Jeff, welcome.
Jeff Anderson, Secretary of Treasury, United Food and Commercial Workers, Local 555. We're a 20,000-member union, primarily grocery industry, throughout the state of Oregon. We want to stand in opposition to this bill. We believe that local control has been well served, whether it's in land use planning or in various panels. This one, focusing on all labor law, kind of misses the point of where Oregon at one point was saying we want to have a high skill, high wage platform. We want to build into the next century good paying jobs. But in fact, I heard testimony that these are cost drivers to business. I would suggest, though, that these are cost drivers to taxpayers because we have now more people in poverty than ever, at least in my lifetime that I'm aware of. And if there's the inability to create threshold standards, whether it's a statewide minimum wage, a statewide sick pay, which I think is a health policy much more broader than a labor policy. It seems remiss that we would shut down local control for innovation to create things that could come to the state. If you go back in history, I mean, there's just in recent contemporary history, a lot of things were innovated by local control. Would we have today a statewide law that regulates the payday loan enterprise? It was Portland that brought that to our attention. It was other communities that followed then to the state, and it just seems that we are cutting ourselves off from local control. We always say local control for school boards and other entities. Home rule should be preserved. We have a long-standing history on that. And, you know, my opposition to this bill could be summed up in what I call the bill. I call it the Preemption Plantation Poverty Enhancement Act, because, in fact, you're saying higher cost areas, you have to take a buy unless the state actually acts. And yet we have a health care earned sick day law that is troubling just to get through the body. I can't imagine any other standards getting through in the current formation. So I strongly encourage that this bill be defeated.
Chair Dimbro, members of the committee, my name is Graham Trainer, and I'm here with the Oregon AFL-CIO, the Statewide Federation of Labor Unions, representing over 300,000 working Oregonians in every community and in every corner of this state. Our members and community partners are all on the front lines of the fight to create an economy that works for all Oregonians in their communities, and we have grave concerns about Senate Bill 814 and its significant impact on these communities throughout the state. Workers and community members have the best, most suitable perspective on what change is needed in their own communities, towns, and cities to achieve these economic fairness objectives. At the same time, local governments have a fundamental obligation of being responsive to the needs of their communities, whether you're in Ontario, Eugene, Medford, or Portland. It has also long been the case, as you've heard, that local governments, those closest to the people they are elected to represent, set standards that often pave the way for eventual statewide standards. While it can take many years for public opinion and cultural shifts to make a statewide policy a reality, after a local government has acted, this avenue for progress and innovation is, from my perspective, a critical part of the fabric that makes Oregon the state we all love. You've obviously already heard today from employers and those in the business community that they desire statewide consistency rather than a smattering of different policies throughout the state, creating a burden from their perspective to efficiency and predictability. While we disagree with this approach completely, we can understand this simple, economic rationale. But I would ask of you, though, is whether communities like Bend and Medford are the same. Are workers in Portland and Astoria facing the same economic realities? Do residents of Ontario or Kaiser feel an economic recession in the same way? Is a worker in Eugene and Albany facing the same cost of living? And Senate Bill 814, as you've heard, is a page out of a playbook of a number of national organizations that aim to interfere with the ability for communities and the local governments that represent them to pass their own laws and seek solutions for problems that arise at the local level. Action on a bill like this, from my perspective, would be a signal to working Oregonians in every corner of our state that their voice and opinion doesn't matter as much, and that the state knows best when it comes to work standards, workplace standards, and a host of other matters, given from what you've heard about being a really broadly written bill. And it sounds like by design. We, along with coalitions we work with in communities around the state, urge you to oppose Senate Bill 814 and ensure that working Oregonians have a voice in finding the right local solutions to local problems that arise in the workplace and beyond. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today and just reiterate what has been said about some of the things that are uploaded to OLIS that really have some specific information about some other more broad unintended consequences that folks with a legal perspective have been able to bring and provide you today. So thanks for the time.
Thank you, Graham. Any questions of this panel? Okay, thank you, all three. Okay, next we have Matt Swanson, Emily McLean, and Bonnie Allen Saylor. And is Emily not here?
She, I believe, is testifying on.
Okay, let's bring up Angela Crowley Cook then.
Okay, I'll I'll kick us off. Chair Denborough, members of the committee, my name is Matt Swanson, representing the more than 60,000 members of the Service Employees International Union here in the state of Oregon, and we urge you to oppose Senate Bill 814. I think much of what I would cover has already been said, so to spare you the redundancy, I think I'll just talk a little bit about the need to be able to represent some different economic dynamics by industry and geography. So when I think of what this bill could preclude is a conversation really about a couple of items. One is transit, and I think of a janitor living in Cornelius and working, say, in the Lloyd District of inner southeast or northeast Portland, excuse me. The inability of a region to really think about how you get low-income workers from a place where they have affordable housing to where they work, and losing some of the either incentives or ability to make certain requirements of employers around transit could be really troubling in an area that is growing and dealing with congestion. So whether it's getting workers to and from work, those who struggle with to afford not just housing but transit, and also dealing with issues of even when they get there, how do they afford to park, assuming they can find a space. I think these are real issues that folks who work on the margins deal with, and I think this legislation, as we interpret it, could remove some of those important discussion from the local areas in which they serve. I think one other piece that I think was very important for us is how certain cities, like the city of Portland, dealt with civil rights at the local level. So looking at issues of discrimination based on sexual orientation was something that was quite troubling to a number of workers, and having those protections under a certain jurisdiction helped move the conversation forward. In fact, I would say even where cities may have disagreed on the topic, that controversy, I guess, that was created between cities hopefully prompted the legislature to act. So in our view, this bill is much, much, much too broad. We think there are a number of issues that certainly have included preemption conversations over time. Issue by issue, I think this legislature has dealt with those. But as a blanket principle, we would object to the direction of this bill. So thank you.
Thank you, Matt. Bonnie, welcome.
For the record, my name is Bonnie Allen Saylor. I'm a staff attorney with the Northwest Workers Justice Project, which provides legal support and advocacy to workers and their organizations, focusing on those most marginalized by the current structure of our economy. I, like many of my colleagues here today, am here to urge your strong opposition to Senate Bill 814. I don't want to repeat a lot of what has already been said, though I definitely second or third or fourth a lot of the concerns around how just incredibly broad this preemption is. You know, you heard from some panels that it was intended to be quite broad, and our fear is that it was actually drafted in a way to be even more broad than that, and really could, in being so broad, result in a huge number of, you know, unintended consequences. Potential for it to preempt actions that we haven't even considered is just really concerning. I would also want to highlight what's been mentioned before, that, you know, these kinds of preemptions have become a really popular strategy for corporations across our country as part of what we see really as a coordinated campaign to interfere with local democracy and try and cut off any grassroots organizing that might be against their interest. And we would just, you know, strongly stress that in a state like Oregon that prides itself on being a model in so many ways and has so many great cities across the state that have been able to innovate in certain ways, that it's just really important to continue to support that. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, Angela Crowley Cook, Oregon Environmental Council. Oregon Environmental Council also opposes SB 814, and I'll just drill down on one of the particular benefits that we're concerned about, and that's the transit benefit. And one thing that hasn't been talked about, I don't think, before, is the benefits not just to employees of some of these benefits, like the transit benefit, but also the benefit to employers and to the economy of the region and Oregon as a whole. So for the transit benefit, employees can voluntarily elect to have up to $130 a month in a taxable salary for tax-free transit or vanpool benefits. So the employees are saving money because they don't have to pay federal income taxes on that money used for transit, but the employers also save money because they're not paying federal taxes on that portion of the salary either. And then for the region, since this benefit provides an incentive for folks to use transit to commute, that reduces traffic congestion, travel delay for freight movement and everyone else. And of course, there are climate benefits, which is another reason why we support it. Now, OEC is a small nonprofit. We have between 15 and 20 employees. We use this benefit. It's really easy to use, and everyone loves it. So it would be a shame to see something like this that benefits employees, employers, the environment, the economy of the region. It'd be a shame for that to go away. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Vice Chair Thatcher.
Thank you. Actually, it's not a question, but you did mention that there was a transit benefit. It sounded interesting that it was voluntarily provided. I guess it wasn't a mandatory benefit. So that wouldn't be covered. That wouldn't be affected by this bill, because this bill has to do with mandatory provision of employment benefits. And then there's also strategies nationwide to start something in a bigger city and then use that as leverage to do it statewide. And for instance, with the paid sick leave, we had Portland and Eugene started it, and then, well, of course, Portland implemented theirs before. So the starting discussion, we couldn't even look at what maybe California was doing as far as providing paid sick leave hours. They up to 24 hours. We decided, well, we have to go with the floor, 56, simply because that's what Portland did. And I just think that that's also a strategy used on the other side. And I won't mention the names of those organizations that are nationwide, but anyhow, do you not recognize that as being a problem for when we're trying to implement or have a thoughtful discussion on statewide policy, where there can be so much influence by the big city, in our case Portland, that really starts the conversation? That's really the starter. It's nothing anything besides that. It has to be what Portland had, otherwise they're afraid that those voters in that area will, or the employees in that area, will be effectively getting less of a benefit. Anyway, just my question is, don't you see there'd be a leverage being used the other way by getting this into the bigger cities? It's not just a local decision.
So, Chair Dembro, Senator Thatcher, thank you for the question. I can answer the transit one, and I'll have to defer to my colleagues for the other portion of that. So thank you for letting me clarify. The transit benefit is optional for employees to use, but certain localities require that employers provide that benefit. So the city of Portland, for example, requires that all employers provide that benefit. It's up to me as the employee if I want to use it or not. I do use it when it's rainy and I don't want a bike.
Got it. And you know, Chair Dembro, Senator Thatcher, I think with regard to the broader question of the strategic deployment of policy initiatives based on locality versus statewide preemption, I think in Oregon it feels that we've settled by and large to an issue-by-issue approach, and there are times where things have been preempted, and I'm not the person to go into the history of all the issues that have been preempted by this body, but I do think that that is the thoughtful approach. Our concern is that the breadth of this bill, you know, takes out a conversation from local governments that may be perfectly appropriate there. I would also say that in the deliberations around other legislation, preemption has been part of the conversation, and I believe advocated for very strongly in this body. So it's tough to say over time how this shakes out, but I think as a core principle, I think coming back to that idea of home rule and not being too broad in how we deal out those preemptions would be appropriate. But again, I think there, you know, you may even go back to the cities and ask them more about where this whole idea of, you know, what and where and how we preempt local action, I think, would be an appropriate conversation. But again, we think this is too broad.
Okay. Thank you, Matt. Thank you, all three of you. We have one last person. Emily McLean has returned. Thank you, Emily.
Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, thank you so much. I have another bill up and another committee. I appreciate the understanding. I want to make just a couple of points. My name is Emily McLean. I'm here representing Basic Rights Oregon, and we are opposed to Senate Bill 814. And I just want to provide a little bit of history briefly. Basic Rights Oregon, first of all, represents the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community and works to ensure that that entire community experiences equality in Oregon. In 1991, the city of Portland added discrimination based on sexual orientation or source of income in housing, employment, and public accommodations to the city's civil rights ordinance. And Portland's ordinance was followed across the state by cities like Corvallis, Ashland, in Benton County, in Multnomah County, Eugene, Bend, Beaverton, and many others. And in 2000, the city of Portland updated its ordinance banning discrimination based on gender identity. This was the first time in a community in Oregon that stepped forward to protect employment rights of the transgender community. I also want to add that it wasn't until 2007, after many failed legislative attempts, that the state of Oregon passed legislation, the Oregon Equality Act, banning discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity in employment. And that act went into effect in January 1st, 2008. And the federal government has yet to take steps to pass legislation that protects workers nationally from discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. I did want to draw your attention that we submitted testimony from Gina Frazzini, the executive director of Basic Rights Oregon. That's available on OLIS, and you can see the point that she made that we wanted to emphasize is that we are concerned about overly broad or I guess basically making sure that local communities and their rights to pass laws that are based on their values and the things that they care about is really important to us. So I'll just stop right there.
Thank you, Emily. Any questions? Okay, thank you. Thank you, Emily. Okay, with that, I'm going to end our public hearing on Senate Bill 814, and I am going to open a work session on Senate Bill 814. Vice Chair Thatcher.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 814 without recommendation to the Committee on Rules.
Vice Chair Thatcher has moved Senate Bill 814 without recommendation to the Committee on Rules. Discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm willing to support the motion without recommendation. I think it's a conversation that there's obviously a lot more to say about. I do have significant concerns about the measure, but I look forward to further discussion in the Rules Committee.
Thank you. There are other comments?
Well, yeah, I would add to that that I think that there definitely are some concerns that need to be dealt with so people would feel more comfortable. And I'm glad we're not just killing it outright, or at least moving it to a committee, at least yet, anyway. I'm sure that's just prolonging the death, perhaps, but, you know, there we go.
Thank you for that insight, Senator. Yeah, this is a subject I promised that we would have a thorough discussion of, and I think we have. I think we've heard a number of good points. I too, remain unconvinced by this bill. You know, kind of following up on your question before, Vice Chair Thatcher, you know, what really struck me with our discussion debate over the sick leave issue was just how few people, you know, I'm not sure we heard from any Portland businesses coming in and complaining about their experience with the actual sick leave ordinance. We heard from cities that don't have such ordinances, their fears, their concerns. And I think that, you know, essentially, you know, we've had the sick leave ordinance in Portland for over a year. The sky hasn't fallen. And that's part of the, I think, the benefit of having the this ability of local entities to try things out. So I would really be opposed to an upfront preemption. However, you know, the request was made to me to send this bill to rules, and I'm happy to vote for that. Any other discussion? Okay, so Carrie, would you please call the roll?
Senator Gelser?
Aye.
Senator Cano?
Aye.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Thatcher?
Aye.
Aye. Okay, the motion passes. This bill goes to the very capable hands of the chair of the Rules Committee. So I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 814, and I will open a work session on Senate Bill 327. Colleagues, this is the first of the bills having to do with minimum wage, which we heard a week ago. Matt, why don't you tell us what this one is?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 327 raises the minimum wage to $12.20 per hour by 2017. It requires the minimum wage to be above the hourly equivalent of the federal poverty guidelines for a family of four, as determined by the United States Department of Health and Human Services. The measure declares an emergency and is effective on passage. Revenue and fiscal statements both came back as light, and there are no amendments.
Okay, thank you, Matt. Vice Chair Thatcher? Oh, Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Senate Bill 327 without recommendation to the Committee on Rules.
Senator Rosenbaum has moved Senate Bill 327 without recommendation to the Committee on Rules. And colleagues, you'll remember that there were a number of minimum wage bills that we heard and which I've scheduled for work sessions. I'm planning to send them all to rules without recommendation rather than have us pick and choose among those, you know, the different rates of the minimum wage. So that's why this is without recommendation. Any discussion of Senate Bill 327 going to rules? Okay, seeing none, is there any objection? Okay, Carrie, would you call the roll?
Senator Gelser?
Aye.
Senator Knope?
No.
Vice Chair Thatcher?
No.
Chair Dembrough?
Aye. Okay, Senate Bill 327 will move to the rule, is sent to the Rules Committee. Close the work session on Senate Bill 327 and open the work session on Senate Bill 332. Matt, you want to tell us about this one?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 332 repeals the preemption of charter and statutory authority of local governments to set minimum wage requirements, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage. There is no revenue impact. There's a light fiscal impact statement and no committee amendments.
Okay. Senator Rosenbaum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Senate Bill 332 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Rules.
Senator Rosenbaum has moved Senate Bill 332 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Rules. And colleagues, this is, you know, I mentioned that the ones that just give the different rates of the minimum wage are being sent to rules without recommendation. The motion here is with a recommendation to pass this removal of preemption. Discussion. Okay, Carrie, would you please call the roll?
Senator Gelser?
Aye.
Senator No?
No.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thatcher?
No.
Chair Dembrough?
Aye. Okay, the motion passes. The bill sent to the Committee on Rules. Close the work session on Senate Bill 332 and open a work session on Senate Bill 380. Matt, remind us of what this one is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 380 grants the Commissioner of the Labor of the Bureau of Labor and Industries discretion over the preparation of formal charges in some instances. There are dash one amendments to this bill, which declare emergency and make the bill effective on passage. There is no revenue impact, and the fiscal statement came back indeterminate.
Mr. Chair, move to adopt the dash one amendments dated April 9th, 2015.
Okay, Vice Chair Thatcher has moved to adopt the dash one amendments dated April 9th, 2015. Any discussion of these amendments? Is there any objection to our adopting these amendments? Seeing none, they are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 380 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Thatcher has moved Senate Bill 380 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? And actually, before we get into discussion, let me just remind you that the problem here is that with BOLI not having discretion over the cases that it takes, it is running up big expenses in taking cases that it otherwise wouldn't. And so this gives the commissioner some discretion over those that it will move forward. Now, the risk here, you may remember, is that HUD will consider this a problem and will no longer contract with BOLI to do the housing cases, and they'll have to go to Seattle to be dealt with. We have been unable to get HUD to tell us up front how they would address this issue. And so, you know, what I'm recommending is that we pass this legislation and see how HUD reacts to it. And if they do, in fact, make a change, if they do, in fact, say that this is no longer something they want BOLI to do, then we will consider changing that, and it's something I've committed to bringing back to this committee next February if need be. So that's kind of the background to this. Any discussion? Okay. Is there any objection to us passing this motion? Seeing none, the motion passes. Senate Bill 380 will go to the floor, and I'll carry it.
Okay,
with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 380, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 470. Matt, which one is this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 470 repeals the law, or as introduced, repeals the law preventing certain employees of educational institutions from receiving unemployment insurance benefits during school breaks. There's a dash one amendment to this that replaces the measure, and it permits school employees who leave their jobs for good cause and without reasonable assurance of returning to the position in the subsequent academic term to receive unemployment insurance benefits. This with dash one also declares an emergency and is effective on passage. There is no revenue impact, and there is an indeterminate impact of the dash one amendments.
Thank you, Matt. Vice Chair Thatcher.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the dash one amendments dated April 17th, 2015.
Vice Chair Thatcher has moved to adopt the dash one amendments dated April 17th, 2015. And colleagues, just to clarify what we're doing here, you'll remember that the original bill would have given mainly classified employees, made them eligible for unemployment insurance during the summer. The fiscal on this was huge, in terms of the impact on school districts, and that obviously is problematic. But during the course, you'll remember that during the course of our discussion of this measure during the public hearing, we did discuss a narrower problem that exists, where people who are who leave their employment not just for the summer, but who leave it permanently, lose eligibility for unemployment during the summer, just because of the way that the law is written. This would fix that narrow problem and would, I think, satisfy at least those concerns. And I don't know, Employment Division, did I get that right? Okay, they're nodding. Any discussion of this?
Yeah, Mr.
Yes,
Chair.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have a definition for good cause? Is there somebody who could
we certainly
help us
do.
With that?
Yes, thanks, Dave.
Thank you, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. For the record, David Gerstenfeld, Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance at the Employment Department. And to your question, Senator Knope, there is a definition. It boils down to someone showing that they faced a grave circumstance, something that a reasonable person wouldn't continue to work under, and that they exhausted all the reasonable alternatives to leaving work. So it is a relatively high threshold.
Okay. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Okay, any further discussion? Okay, seeing none, is there any objection to our adopting Senate Bill 470? To our adopting the dash one amendments. Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 470 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Vice Chair Thatcher has moved Senate Bill 470 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Okay, is there any objection? The motion passes. Anybody want to carry this? Senator?
No. Would you like to carry it?
Senator Thatcher? Oh, I can, sure.
Sure, okay. Great. Okay, Vice Chair Thatcher will carry. Close the work session on Senate Bill 470. Open the work session on Senate Bill 552. Matt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 552 establishes workplace protections for certain domestic workers, including overtime pay, periods of rest, and freedom from harassment. The measure grants the Bureau of Labor and Industries the authority to adopt implementation rules and classifies violations as unlawful employment practices and defines relevant terms. There are a couple sets of amendments that were proposed for this measure. The Dash 1 amendments remove many of the employer requirements. The Dash 3 amendments exclude persons who perform house sitting duties, persons who exchange for an in-kind service, and children under the age of 26. It permits written notice to be waived in emergencies and upon mutual consent. It permits reasonable restrictions on in-home workers' food preparation and limits the mandatory paid time off to workers who've averaged at least 30 hours per week of work in the previous year, and also removes the record-keeping requirements. There is no revenue impact specifically to the Dash 3 amendments, and there is a minimal fiscal impact to the Dash 3 amendments.
Okay, Vice Chair Thatcher.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendments dated April 17, 2015.
Vice Chair Thatcher has moved to adopt the Dash 3 amendments dated April 17, 2015. Any discussion? Is there any objection to our adopting these amendments? Seeing none, they are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 552 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Thatcher has moved Senate Bill 552 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Knope.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank Senator Gelser for working in a bipartisan way to, I think, make this bill a better bill and a really strong bill. And I think we should get a strong bipartisan vote on the floor because of that. And so I'm happy to support this bill.
Thank you. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I also would like to extend my thanks to Senator Knope for reaching out to my office with some good suggestions and helping to make it a better bill.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Does anybody else on the panel want to thank us?
Because
you can.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'd like to thank Matt. He sent in the amendment request.
I'd like to thank you for asking me to send an amendment request.
I would like to thank Senator Thatcher for making the motion and Senator Rosenbaum for NPR caucus meetings.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion, is there any objection to the motion? Okay, seeing none, the motion passes. Senate Bill 552 goes to the floor Senator Gelser, would you like to carry?
Unless Senator Cook will carry with me.
Okay, Senator Gelser will carry. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 552, and open the work session on Senate Bill 597. And this, I think, is another one of those minimum wage ones.
Yep.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 597 without recommendation to the Committee on Rules.
Senator Rosenbaum has moved Senate Bill 597 without recommendation to the Committee on Rules. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, Carrie, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Gelser?
Aye.
No.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Thatcher? Aye. The motion carries and the bill goes to the Committee on Rules. Close the work session on Senate Bill 597. And I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 610. And this, I think, is another one of those.
Yes.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 610 without recommendation to the Committee on Rules.
There's an amendment to this?
Yeah, there's a proposed amendment.
Okay. Is that what I answered on this?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Actually, before I recognize that motion, I think there's an amendment that's been proposed.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. There are -3 amendments proposed for this measure, which establish a tax credit for wages paid to the to minimum wage employees over $9.10 an hour. And because this measure is slated to go to rules, both fiscal and revenue introduce light analyses for the measure.
Mr. Chair, I could speak to the amendment.
Please.
The -3 amendments, when fully implemented,
And just back up. So this is the minimum wage that takes it to $15 an hour. Yeah.
Yes, and in stages. You know, it's a 3-year implementation. And when you get into the fully implemented biennium, legislative revenue indicated that the cost is $3,178,000,000. So not only is that revenue, obviously, to employees, but it's also expense to the employer, and so that's you know, that's the cost to business who would have to move their employees to $15 an hour, which is, I think, pretty significant. And so I think it's important to note that and to understand what the full ramifications are of moving in that direction that quickly. And so, obviously, Oregon has one of the top minimum wages in the country, hovering between second and third place, usually. And we had a lot of testimony on the effect of what would happen to business, especially that competes outside of Oregon and that competes on a world stage with many of our ag products. And This is just the initial cost and not the full impact of what that could mean when losing business and so on. So I just thought it was important to bring that up. And now the good chair of rules will also have that information when you contemplate Senate Bill 610.
Great. So we'll just leave that amendment for the Rules Committee. Does that make
sense?
That's
fine, yeah.
Do you want me to restate
no,
my motion?
No, that's fine. We'll turn the clock back about 3 minutes, and I've just realized that Senator Rosenbaum has moved Senate Bill 610 without recommendation to the Committee on Rules. Is there any further discussion? Okay, seeing none, Carrie, would you please call the roll?
Senator Gelser?
Aye.
Senator Knope?
No.
Aye.
Vice Chair Thatcher?
No.
Chair Deborah?
Aye. Okay, the motion passes. Senate Bill 610 goes to the Committee on Rules. close the work session on Senate Bill 610, open a work session on Senate Bill 682. Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Senate Bill 682 without recommendation to the Committee on Rules.
Senator Rosenbaum has moved Senate Bill 682 without recommendations to the Committee on Rules. Any discussion? Seeing none, Carrie, please call the roll.
Senator Gelser?
Aye.
Senator Knope?
No.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thatcher?
No.
Aye. The motion carries. This one, too, goes to rules. And I think that's our last of those. We close the work session on Senate Bill 682. Open a work session on Senate Bill 701. Yeah, could you remind us what this one is?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 701 establishes a process for the random selection of physicians from a list of qualified physicians maintained by the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services for medical examinations and workers' compensation claims. There are -1 amendments for this measure, which require the establishment of a process for out-of-state independent medical examinations. There is no revenue impact, and there is a light fiscal impact. The impact statement is a fiscal light.
Yeah. It could be a heavy.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 701 without recommendation to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay. Vice Chair Thatcher has moved Senate Bill 701 without recommendation to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion? Is there any objection to this bill going to Ways and Means?
I'm going to vote no, just as a signal to some of the folks down at Ways and Means to take a closer look at this. I'm quite frankly not sure how I feel about this bill, but I think it could have bigger impacts than I think maybe we're thinking about. But so I'll be a no, but could be a yes on the floor if one of my questions or I think get answers.
I've lost track of which number we're on.
We're on 701.
Thank you.
Yeah, and colleagues, I should tell you that this bill is not coming to us with MLAC's recommendation. They think it needs further work, and that's why we're sending it without recommendation down to Ways and Means.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to have policy stuff down in Ways and Means, but in order for this bill to move forward, I think it should have something. So I would hope that maybe they would stay in touch with the members of this committee if they decide that they're going to work it in a policy way before they kick it out.
So, colleagues, we have to back up. There actually are -1 amendments to this, and so we should get those adopted.
Mr. Chair,
give a date for those.
Yeah.
Hold on just a sec.
Move slowly. Okay. I move we adopt the -1 amendments dated April 8th, 2015.
Thank you. Okay, Vice Chair Thatcher has moved the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 701 dated April 8th, 2015. And do you remember what those did?
Yes, the -1 amendments require the establishment of a process for out-of-state independent medical examinations.
Okay, great. Okay, any discussion of these?
Mr. Chair, does this replace the bill or just add to it?
No, it just adds to it. Any discussion? Any objection to us adopting the -1s? Seeing none, they are adopted. Okay. Why don't you restate the motion? Thanks.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 701 as amended without recommendation to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Thatcher has moved Senate Bill 701 as amended without recommendation to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Any further discussion? Carrie, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Gelser?
Aye.
Senator Knope?
No.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thacker?
Aye.
Chair Dembrough? Aye. The motion passes. The bill goes to Ways and Means. Close the work session on Senate Bill 701, and I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 718. Yeah. Yeah, we have to do the dash symbols, right? Yeah. Okay. So, colleagues, 718 is the wage theft bill that we heard last week, and it has been amended. We now have dash six amendments. Do you want to tell us what the dash sixes do, Matt, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, Senate Bill 718 is introduced. It defines wages for certain wage claims, requires the employer to maintain time and pay records of terminated employees for 3 years from the date of termination, and to provide records to the employee if requested, and to provide to the employee a written statement for reasons of termination. The measure modifies information that must be included in this itemized statement provided to the employee each pay period and establishes a civil right of action for certain wage claims for unpaid wages and for violation of certain wage statutes. The measure specifies procedures for establishing a lien for the amount of unpaid wages and authorizes the Commissioner of Bureau of Labor Industries to void notice of lien if the Commissioner determines that the employee has failed to establish a prima facie case for a wage claim. The measure prohibits a waiver of rights and prohibits determination by the employer against employees for certain actions taken by the employee related to wage claims. However, there are a number of amendments that were introduced and are submitted and posted on all lists. There are dash one amendments, which remove the abilities of employees to file notice of a list pendants claim upon the employer's property. There are dash twos, which reduce the time required for keeping employee records from 3 years to 1 year. Dash threes, which retain the authority of the court to award attorney fees to prevailing defendants. Dash fours, which remove the ability of the employee to file notice of list pendants upon the employer's property, reduces the time required for keeping employee records from 3 years to 1 year, retains the authority of the court to award attorney's fees to prevailing defendants, and removes the employer requirement to issue a statement regarding employee's termination. Finally, there are dash six amendments, which permit the employer to issue a statement regarding at-will employee's termination, specifies the formula for a calculation of civil penalties, retains the authority of the court to award attorney fees to the prevailing defendant, modifies provisions related to wage withholding statements, removes the ability of the employee to file notice of list pendants upon employer's property, and adjusts the provisions relating to damages. There's a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue statement.
Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to adopt the Dash 6 amendment dated April 17, 2015.
Okay, Senator Rosenbaum has moved to adopt the Dash 6 amendments dated April 17th, 2015. Any discussion? Okay, is there any objection to our adopting these amendments to the bill? Okay, seeing none, they are adopted. Senator.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 718 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Rules.
Senator Rosenbaum has moved Senate Bill 718 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Rules. Is there any discussion?
I think. Thank you, Chair Dembrough. I think it's a much better bill with the amendments. I think it could be even better.
You want to make it even better.
So there may be a minority report on this one, but let's see how the vote turns out.
Okay. It is going to rules.
It's going to rules.
Or it has the opportunity to become
all right.
Even better.
Even better.
Wow. Further discussion, colleagues. Okay. Seeing none, Carrie, would you please call the roll?
Aye.
Senator Knope?
No.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Thacker?
No.
Chair Dembrough? Aye. Okay, the motion passes. This bill will go to rules. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 718, open a work session on Senate Bill 809. And we have dash four amendments to this. Yeah, why don't you tell us what we're doing?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 809, forgive me, there's a bit of a long explanation of this one, requires public contract bidders for contracts of $1 million or more to demonstrate responsibility by employing apprentices for 10% or more of the contract hours during the previous calendar year, or by belonging to a local joint committee whose training agents employed apprentices for 10% or more of hours that training agent employees worked on contracts in the previous calendar year. It grants the Commissioner of Bureau and Labor Industries discretion in the percentage at which a public agency may determine public contract bidder's responsibility, and requires the contracting agency to base responsibility determination on bidder's status as approved training agent or on local joint committee's training agents. It requires contractors and subcontractors to submit compliance statements and appropriates money to the Bureau to enforce verification. The measure requires local joint training committee to report to the Bureau hours worked by apprentices and journey workers, and requires the Bureau to publish hours on the Bureau's website. Becomes operative January 1st, 2017, declares an emergency effective on passage. There are dash four amendments to this bill, which apply only to which make it so that the provisions apply only to contractors with public contracts in $3 million or greater. It starts at $5 million or greater and then phases down to $3 million or greater at different time periods, and requires the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries to recommend to the Legislative Assembly by December 31st, 2022, any reductions in the estimated contract price at which this measure should apply. The Revenue Office's LRO has determined that there is no revenue impact, and we received a light fiscal statement.
It's destined for Ways and Means. Is that the reason?
That is correct.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to adopt the Dash 4 amendment dated April 15th, 2015.
Senator Rosenbaum has moved to adopt the Dash 4 amendments dated April 15th, 2015. And colleagues, just for explanation, the for these amendments, the primary concern that we had with the bill before these amendments was its potential impact on rural parts of the state. And there was a request to increase the threshold from $1 million projects up to $5 million. I was told that somewhere between $3 and $5 million should exempt most of the rural areas from difficulty in implementing this, if there were, if there were any difficulty, and so, as a way of dealing with that concern, we have the threshold raised to $5 million for 4 years, and then it goes down to $3 million for 4 years, and then at that point, the legislature will receive a report from BOLI as to whether they think it can go down below $3 million. What we've seen in the state of Washington, they started with a certain threshold, and over time were able to lower it. So it that methodology seems to make sense. The other thing that the bill does is it requires BOLI to annually report to the legislature on the impact of the program, which is designed to increase the number of apprentices around the state, looking at gender, at race, at the completion rates by which apprentices move from apprenticeship all the way to journey worker status. And a particular emphasis on the impact on the rural parts of the state in terms of our ability to produce apprentices, and also any potential impacts on employers and contracting agencies. So, I think that the bill has satisfied really the major concerns. The amendments have satisfied the major concerns, and I would recommend an aye vote. Is there any further discussion of the amendments? Okay, is there any objection to our adopting the Dash 4 amendments? Seeing none, they are adopted. Senator?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 809 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Rosenbaum has moved Senate Bill 809 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion of the bill? Senator Knope.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I think the bill is better with the amendments. I think it could be even better. And again, if they are wanting to do policy done in Ways and Means or make changes to make it better, I hope they talk to people who actually work in this area, because I think there are broader concerns than maybe just the ones that we dealt with. But I think that there are good answers to those questions and ways to make it better. So I'll be a no vote to Ways and Means, again, to flag the folks down there that probably more attention needs to be paid to this, because I don't think it's just a rural area issue.
Yes, Vice Chair Thatcher.
Totally separate topic. Just wanted to declare a potential conflict out of an abundance of caution that we always talk about, just because through my company I may participate on a project where this might apply as a sub, probably. Right. So there you go.
So noted. Okay, Carrie, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Gelser?
Aye.
No.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thatcher?
No.
Chair Debra?
Aye. Motion passes. Senate Bill 809 goes to the Committee on Ways and Means. Close the work session on Senate Bill 809. Open the work session on Senate Bill 845. So, colleagues, Senate Bill 845 is the one. It has to do with the health care benefits on large employers whose employees are using public resources. And we have a dash one amendment for this. When did we hear that? Was that just a week ago?
Yep.
Wow. Okay. Senator Rosenbaum, or who's making the motion? Dash one amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the dash one amendment dated April 15th, 2015.
Okay, Senator Rosenbaum moves to adopt the dash one amendment dated April 15th, 2015. What does it do?
The dash one amendments change the employer size threshold to 250 employees, amends the definition of relevant terms, recalibrates the employer fee formula, creates a grace period for certain provisions in the measure, and the Revenue and Fiscal Office didn't, knowing that this is to move on to Ways and Means, issued light statements for both.
Okay. So the Dash 1 amendments satisfy all concerns, and it could not become a better bill, Senator Knope, just to sort of preempt any comment.
Yeah. Now I can't say anything.
Okay, Senator Rosenbaum.
I think I had just moved the dash one amendment.
Yeah. Okay, any discussion?
Thank you. I appreciate that amendment.
Yeah. Is there any objection to our adopting the amendments? Okay, amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 845 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay. Senator Rosenbaum has moved Senate Bill 845 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion?
Nope. I got some.
Okay.
This became a great bill for companies under 249 employees. But I think this is going to be really hard to implement, and I remember just the last couple of sessions dealing with this, and I've had some really good discussions with people about it, but I'm not quite sure it is as good as it could be. So again, I will be a no vote.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Gelser.
I just had a question reading through this, and I'm trying to find it again. In one place it says 250, and in one place it says 100. What's the difference between the two? An amendment, yeah.
I don't remember. Is it a phase in, phase out kind of thing?
I'm not sure. Sorry.
I just wanted to make sure we don't have a drafting error.
No, no, I'm sure we don't. Probably phasing. Yes, it is phasing.
Yeah, this is a phase in issue.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, any further discussion?
So then just to clarify, Mr. Chair, it will eventually apply to employers with 100 employees.
Yes.
Okay.
By 2019. Okay, Carrie, would you call the roll, please?
Aye.
No.
Aye.
Vice Chair Thatcher?
No.
Chair
Decker? Aye. Motion passes. Bill goes to Ways and Means. I close the work session on Senate Bill 845 and open a work session on Senate Bill 885. Right. So this is the one, colleagues, that has to do with Lane County forest timber payments and being used for CTE and youth employment. There are dash one amendments. Vice Chair?
Hey, Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the dash one amendment dated April 2nd, 2015.
Senator Thatcher has moved to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated April 2nd, 2015. And what is the effect of this amendment?
Thank you. The Dash 1 amendments require that the first $500,000 received by Lane County be directed to the career and technical education programs and defines which career and technical education programs are eligible and requires Lane County to report on programs funded with this money.
Okay. So it focuses the bill. Yes, Senator Knope.
I just have a question. So does it still affect, I mean, this is still money that comes out of the formula and therefore would affect every other district?
Potentially, yes. That's why we have the subsequent to revenue. Okay. Senator Gelser.
Got my note. I think CTE is great. I think we should be looking for all the opportunities that we can, but I am concerned about that impact on the state school fund and the equalization issues.
Right. So we are kind of jumping ahead to the discussion of the main motion, which is fine. But, you know, I'll just say that, you know, the purview of this committee is things like CTE and youth employment and trying to figure out ways to do that. Now, if it has an impact on other parts of the budget, including the school formula, I'm sure revenue will try to balance that. But my goal in moving this forward would be to speak to the merits of local programs having to do with career technical and youth employment. But going back to the Dash 1 amendments, are there any objections to our adopting those Dash 1 amendments? Okay, seeing none, they are adopted. And now to the main motion.
Senator. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 885 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Finance and Revenue.
Vice Chair Thatcher has moved Senate Bill 885 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Finance and Revenue. Okay, is there any further discussion of this? Okay, Carrie, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Gelser?
No.
No.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair
Aye. And the motion passes, and the bill goes to the Committee on Finance and Revenue. We close the work session on Senate Bill 885 and open work session on Senate Bill 888. Colleagues, this is our last bill. Matt, could you remind us what this one is?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, I hopefully don't take up the remaining time we have with this description, although it is a bit lengthy. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 888 requires employers to provide employees upon hire a written work schedule and permits the employee to request a flexible or predictable work schedule from the employer, subject to certain restrictions. The measure requires employers to grant employees requests for flexible or predictable work schedules unless prevented by a bona fide business reason. It requires employers to post in an accessible location a physical copy of work schedules to all employees and requires the employer to pay for scheduled hours of work, regardless of hours actually worked, up to a maximum of 4 hours. The measure grants the Commissioner of Bureau and Labor Industries the authority to adopt additional rules and requires the employer to provide notices of scheduled changes and compensate employees for changes in certain circumstances. It establishes unlawful employment practice for the retaliation against employees who request flexible or predictable schedules and defines relevant terms. There are dash one amendments for this bill that place provisions on the in the place the provisions of the measure in ORS Chapter 653 and requires employers to provide a work schedule 21 days in advance. These amendments also require employers to compensate employees for changes in the work schedule. The Revenue Office determined that there is no revenue impact, and the Legislative Fiscal Office issued a light fiscal impact statement under the understanding that this is being referred under rules.
Okay, thank you, Matt. Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated April 2nd, 2015.
Okay. Senator Rosenbaum has moved to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated April 2nd, 2015. Any discussion of these amendments? Is there any objection to the amendments? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 888 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Rules.
Senator Rosenbaum has moved Senate Bill 888 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation that it be referred to the Committee on Rules. Any discussion? Okay. Carrie, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Gelser?
Aye.
Senator Knope?
No.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye. No.
Aye. Motion passes. This bill goes to the Committee on Rules. Do good with it, Senator Rosenbaum. With that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 888. Colleagues, good work. And due to the fact that we have no more bills from the Senate to be worked, and considering how beautiful the weather is, you have the rest of the week off. We are adjourned.
The rest of the week?
Yes.
From everything?
Yes.
From everything?